So, as we see the first six chapters in the essays on the Gita, Sri Aurobindo gives us a background. This is unlike the traditional reading of the Gita, where you basically take it out from the Mahabharata and you read it as a scripture which is going to help us in our spiritual development. But if we decontextualize the Gita, there are certain problems. For example, one of the important elements that Sri Aurobindo emphasizes is that who is the teacher? It is not just Krishna the charioteer. Krishna is the divine, embodied divine. So that makes a difference to the meaning. And the Gita is being revealed to Arjun. So this revelation of the truth of a scripture, though the words are there, the language is there, the meaning is there apparently, yet the revelation comes to a certain category of disciple, a certain category of seeker to whom the Gita reveals itself. We may read the words, we may recite the words, that's well known. And yet its sense, intrinsic sense, is revealed to a kind of humanity which Arjun represents. And we know that Arjun is the warrior soul, and as Sri Aurobindo says, in one of his aphorisms, there are three stages of human development. And of course, he paraphrases Nietzsche. One is when you are a camel man. Camel man is the stage when you are bearing the burden of life as it comes to us. And people want to escape from that burden of life and turn to God. Of course, everyone can turn to God. But there is a stage through which one has to go. After the camel man, which bears the burden of life, comes the lion man. Lion man must take the challenge of life, face it, and be a victor. Then comes the child man, which is a stage of happy wonder and turning toward the divine as a child playing in the garden. So the stage of lion man, which must come in everybody's life, and if you take it, the three lines through which nature operates, the tamasic, where you are just bearing the burden of life, and the rajasic, where you wrestle with life, and the sattvic, which is a state of luminous joy. So these are the three stages of development, and the Gita is given to Arjun, a person who is in a state of utter tamas. Even if he reads the Gita, he may not get its real sense. Or a person who is living already in a sattvic buddhi, to him, the Gita may reveal a very different sense. As Sri Aurobindo has said, that somebody who is living with the sense of duty and the kartavyam, or a Buddha who comes and asks, what should I do? Krishna is not going to tell him that, go back to the Shakya kingdom and govern the kingdom. He would tell him, follow your quest, and which will take you further. So this is an important background. And now comes the other important aspect of the Gita, which is the context in which it is taking place. It is a very unique scripture in that sense. It is not given in a hermitage. It is not, there is no class going on you know, either a study circle or a 10-day course in which Sri Krishna is telling us the secrets. It is a grim state, battlefield, and a real battlefield. Of course, inner battle, outer battle, we'll come to that. But it's a real battle. The interesting part is that Arjun knows one day before that they are going to go for a battle. He is one of those who have happily agreed. He is a Kshatriya. They look forward to a battle. He has never shrunk from battle. And then suddenly in the morning, till morning he is fine. He has all the celestial weapons, everything at his disposal. But in the morning he says, I want to see who are these people who have gathered to invite, fight. And so Sri Krishna takes him. That's when, looking at those who are on the other side, Arjun is overtaken by what is called as Vaishnavi Maya. Vaishnavi Maya, as Sri Aurobindo says in his Bengali writings, Introduction to the Gita, this too was part of Krishna's play. So Vaishnavi Maya is a heart of pity, kindness, and you know, a feeling that why should we kill, why should we hurt, why should we harm, why should we injure anyone. Better it is that we renounce the kingdom, give away everything, rather than fight. So this is the Vaishnavi Maya which shrinks from the battle, or rather because of a kind of pity that human heart is overtaken by. So this is what happens to Arjun, and he says, I don't want to fight. On the other side, the actual Gita, meaning thereby the Gita which we know today of 700 slokas, it starts equally on the other side. There is Dhritarashtra, the blind king, who asks Sanjay, tell me what's happening on the battlefield. Dharmashetre, Kurukshetre, Samaveta, Yuyutsava, Mamaveka, Pandavaishya, Kimukarvati Sanjay, my children as well as Pandav's children, what are they doing on the battlefield? Pray tell me, Sanjay. So Sanjay starts the narration. Now we have these two narrations. On one side, Duryodhana looks at the opposite army and he is filled with a sense of vain glory, looking at the warriors, and believes nobody can ever dethrone him. Whereas Arjun is overtaken by pity and the absurdity of war. Both are looking at a grim reality. So there are various ways through which we can look at existence. Shubhendu advises us, first step is look at existence in the face. So what happens when we look at existence in the face? Not through the lens of theories. Not through our all systems. If somebody, oh, this because of his previous karma, oh, God is very nice, kind, but what is all this? So better we go into a forest, hermitage, and do some sadhana, as you said. So looking at existence in the face, we see the grim reality that life is not easy, not simple. It is full of challenges, difficulties, even fights, quarrels, all kinds of things are there in life. So when we look at existence squarely, it becomes difficult to make sense of it with a God who is kind, who is loving. That's what our image of God is. He is benevolent, he is compassionate, and therefore it becomes very difficult to reconcile a God that we have erected in our own mind. And of course God has these qualities, these beautiful things, with the facts on the ground. So even Dhritarashtra and all of them cannot understand that if Krishna is God, as they say, why is this happening? Krishna is God. He should be very easy. It should be very easy for him to just make sure that somehow war doesn't take place. So this is a question that we all ask when we look at existence in the face. Even if in our personal life we have no problem, apparently, we are not blessed to have misfortune. As Shubhendu says, O misfortune, blessed art thou, because you have shown me the face of my beloved. But if you look at the world around, how much ever you may say, we may say that good man doesn't suffer, but good people suffer, often outwardly more than the so-called bad guys. So it throws a challenge at our understanding. So human mind has tried to resolve this dilemma in several ways. One is the most surface kind of thought, which says there is no God actually, you know. Why? Because if God was there, there should not be all of this. So this is one of the ways that human mind has tried to resolve this dilemma. There is no God. If God was there, there would not be fight. There would not, like many people keep saying, in Auroville and Ashram, they see conflicts and they say, oh, this cannot be Divine Mother's creation. And I have to tell them that this is precisely because it is Divine Mother's creation that you will see many more challenges, and not going into its detail. Others say there are two gods. Like, you know, in the Zoroastrianism, you have Ahura Mazda. So there is this God, creator God, who is benevolent, and he creates two beings, two children. One is a God who is very kind, nice, goody-goody. And the other who is evil, who brings evil into the world. So at least it is from one that the two have come into existence. And all life afterwards, whatever follows, is the fight between these two guys to take hold of the possession of the earthly life and human beings. Another theory is that God is all good. He sits above. He has nothing to do with creation. It's all an illusion. Somehow it has come into existence. We don't have to bother about it. We have to bother only about that which is beyond it. A fourth theory is there is God and there is Satan. Both are equal powers fighting with each other. So there are several ways human mind has started, tried to resolve it. But none of them is complete because it's not a reconciliation. It's because if there is ultimate reconciliation, there should be unity. You're always creating two. So Shobindo says that, you know, first thing we must do is look existence in the face. And if we go deep inside existence, we observe a few things. One is that war, battle, struggle is not new to our generation or to life. It has been there from the very moment life has emerged. How did life emerge? If we really look at, there was a very nice little book by this Richard Bach, Illusions, and has a small little note. How life is emerging, struggling against matter. If you see these algae, they are clinging to rocks. Can equally say it's trying to breathe, trying to come out. Once it comes out, the whole universe is teeming with life. At least our earth becomes green clad and brown clad and yellow clad. Once it emerges, but before its emergence, it is something that is struggling. So it is, we can say it's a battle between life and material existence. Life wins. Who knows after how many billion years? If we go by the accounts, after 15 billion years, life emerges. Then again, at several levels, within life itself, there is a struggle, which people like Darwin and others have noted. There is a struggle for survival. What will survive? What will not survive? And there is a battle and tussle. And through all this, life evolves. Who knows where? This is something very evident. Meaning thereby, war is not new. And if we are shocked by it today, we must remember that mankind even of old was shocked by it. Even when we read the Gita 4,500 years back, even then they were warriors. And even in the family of warriors, they were shocked that such a battle where fratricidal war is going to take place. So both tendencies, on one side war, on the other side, the urge for peace, harmony, both instincts are there in human beings. This is the instinct to fight and this is the instinct to peace and harmony. The good news or the bad news is that very often this urge, instinct for peace and harmony, to realize it, one has to travel through the doorways of war. That is what is Kurukshetra about. This world is divine play, but before it becomes, so it should be a playground. But before it becomes a playground, you have to go through the battleground. This is what Sri Aurobindo is reminding us. And this battle takes place at several levels. It takes place outwardly. It takes place within us. It takes place in the microcosm. It takes place in the macrocosm. At every point of time, so many forces we are releasing in this universe which are clashing with other forces. Even if we do nothing, as the mother says, we have contradictory wills. So within us, we want something and we also want it opposite. So what is happening? They're fighting with each other. Or let's take an exam where one is competing. So several people are trying, their will has gone into the cosmic pool and others' will has also gone into the cosmic pool. Now they are clashing and the result will be that some people will get across and others will not get across. So there's this constant aspect of existence where we are seemingly struggling, fighting, at war, within, with others, with all life that is around us. So Sri Aurobindo asks us not to run away from this, because those who run away from this and they want to have a yoga where life is full of peace, harmony, you can't have it. This is a condition, this is a classroom. You can't jump from kindergarten to graduation without going through those examinations which everybody dreads. That's how life is. Why it is so, Sri Aurobindo will reveal to us. And how we should go through this battlefield, that Sri Aurobindo will reveal to us. But it is there, you can't avoid. People, when they would come in any evolutionary struggle, when people, of course, people have tried, there are movements, spiritual movement, which have tried to bypass, spiritual bypassing. Some people want spiritual bypass. And with that last note, I'll read. So spiritual bypass, just like you have a bypass surgery, is you don't want to make the effort and take the challenge of life. So you want a place where you can rest, relax, meditate, food is provided, and there are some nice mantra chantings going on in the atmosphere, and you are quietly sitting and learning meditation. Everybody is very kind, very nice, very lovely. This spiritual bypass. In an evolutionary process, spirituality, it is not allowed. You have to go through this. You see, it's very interesting. When you read the Ramayana, you see that this place through which Rama goes is called Dandakaranya. And Dandakaranya is known for two things. One, it is infested with demons. Man-eating demons. Impossible-seeming demons. At the same time, Dandakaranya is the home to many rishis and sages. Among them, sage Agastya, who is known for, you know, Shurvindo's own past life. He has made his ashram there. But an ashram which is surrounded by a kind of energy field in which nothing adverse can enter. That's the kind of ashram he has built. So within the ashram, everything is fine. But he still wants Ram to come and help him. Because he has created a safe zone. But the world outside is still infested with the demon. And therefore, as the story goes, when Ram goes and he is waiting for him, and then he gives him all the celestial weapons, he says, that's your job. You have to go out and take the challenge. Because otherwise, it's such a beautiful place. Anybody who comes there is protected automatically. He says, you have to go and take the challenge of life. And this challenge of life is what is Kurukshetra. It's chapter 5 of Essays on the Gita. And Shobindu speaks about the question that human life and action raises when we look at world. Second paragraph, page 39. But what then is it that makes the difficulty for the man who has to take the world as it is and act in it and yet would live within the spiritual life? Common question everybody asks. That, you know, there is material life and spiritual life, how to reconcile. They have this illusion that if you take to a spiritual life, you are in a very calm, peaceful. People often, oh, very nice, you have taken retirement and now you are in the peaceful atmosphere. No doubt it is peaceful. But this peace is the basis for a tremendous journey in which you have to fight within at every step. Peace is given. So when people would come to the mother and say, I have completed my retirement and everything, and now I want to join the ashram, I want some peace, I have fulfilled all my duties, obligations and responsibilities. So mother would say, if you want peace, you go nearby to Tiruvannamalai. She would send them. This is not a place where you want to just lead a retired life and find peace. Peace is given, but peace is not the goal here, it's a beginning point. Strangely, you know, if that peace was not given, people would not continue through the struggle. Something is there which is already given. But after that, the real game begins. And the mother says, these are the two aspects of grace. One, where it gives peace and calm to the war-torn heart. Second, where it pushes us for progress. And this pushing for progress is what creates the challenges. So, this is one part. Then somebody wrote to Shurbindo something very similar. 60, 70, whatever, that now I want to now dedicate or leave the rest of my life thinking of God. So he applies to the ashram, and Shurbindo says it's a time to apply for the graveyard, not the ashram. So what is it that appalls us? What is this aspect of existence which appalls his awakened mind? So you see, Duryodhana is not appalled by it. Because he is not an awakened mind. Somebody was asking the other day, why is it only sensitive people get so much touched by these horror things and other, they get affected, they sometimes lose their balance. But there are so many who are watching it. I said, yes, snakes are not afraid of snakes. As simple as that. An animal is very comfortable in the jungle. But if you put a man there, he is going to be uncomfortable. I've had this experience like that in Masai Mara, suddenly getting out of the bus. And I felt all around as if 1,000 eyes, animal-like eyes. And animals are very nice. They are not demons and ogres in human. So, there much of humanity lives in that state. It is not awakened. So, for Duryodhana, Duryodhana doesn't feel, Oh, they are my brothers. They are my own cousins. He is looking at the throne that he must occupy. But Arjun has reached that point where his mind is awakened. So he is raising questions. Awakened mind and brings about what the title of the first chapter of the Gita calls significantly the yoga of the dejection of Arjun. Arjuna Vishad Yoga. So here yoga is because of a strange dejection one feels when one looks at worldly life. The dejection and discouragement felt by the human being when he is forced to face the spectacle of the universe as it really is, with the veil of the ethical illusion, the illusion of self-righteousness torn from his eyes before a higher reconciliation with himself is effected. So it's not the universe that is an illusion. World is not the illusion. But we look at it through various lenses. And one of them is, the most difficult is the veil of ethical illusion. God is good. He is just. So he must do justice. I had a problem with my neighbor and I was right. So I must win in the court battle, or I am the one who must be rewarded. This is the ethical illusion. And when that is torn, when you see face to face, no, it is not like that. People often ask, even recently somebody was asking, why is it that within the ashram you see certain people who go through so much intense suffering, pain, etc. I said, yes, because they have taken the greater challenge. Who gets asphyxiated? Who wants to climb Mount Everest? He has to face the challenge of asphyxia, not somebody who is walking on level ground. So when you take that, Shobindu put it in one of the letters this way, if you want to fly high at a great speed, you cannot afford to misconduct your aeroplane. If you want to walk on the level ground, there are some risks, but if you are flying high, even a bird, even a slight this thing and it crashes. So the greater the ascent, the greater the challenge. But we have this idea that God is like us, very ethical, moral. But if you look at nature, he has already told us in the previous chapter, nature acts amorally and God also acts amorally. There are other considerations. But man has an awakened moral sense and it is needed for us until we are ready to transcend it. That's where we see that moral sense is not awakened in Duryodhan, so he is not yet ready for the Gita. It is awakened in Bhishma, but he has subdued it to his own idea of what he should do and what he should not do. His ego, his promise, etc., etc. It is awakened in Arjuna, but the time has come for him to transcend this moral and ethical sense and live by the will of God. This is what is happening, the stage. It is that aspect which is figured outwardly in the carnage and massacre of Kurukshetra and spiritually by the vision of the Lord of all things as time arising to devour and destroy the creatures whom it has made. This was for me personally one of the difficulties, not looking at life. Life is fine. But reading the Gita, when suddenly that 11th chapter where you see Sri Krishna devouring, I just said, how is it? And it described graphically that all these heroes are in his, what is called, jaw, and he's crushing them. He's having a nice crunchy munchy. And not only the bad, so-called bad guys, even the good, Arjun, all of them are going into his mouth. Of course, they are emerging from another mouth. But nevertheless, when Sri Krishna reveals himself as time the destroyer. That's why Shobindu says Krishna is Kali. That he is Shyam and she is Shyama, the Kali. But he has put forward, when he puts forward, when Kali holds back her violent bosom and puts forward her intense love and sweetness, intense love and sweetness, then it's Krishna. When she holds back Krishna within her bosom and puts forward her intense love as something which is going to take away all that stands between you and the Lord and this world from manifesting the divine, then she becomes Kali. This is the difference. Sweetness, Shobindu describes in Savitri very beautifully. Several places he described this combination of Krishna and Kali. In his own yoga, this played a very prominent part. And he says, if the name of Krishna and Kali has begun to appear in you, it's a very good sign. Not that everybody has to go through that. But in his own case, you see, before Sri Krishna came into his life, people forget, Kali came into his life. Look at his experience of the world mother at Chandod, where he sees Kali. He is seeing an image of Kali and then he sees the world mother. He writes Bhavani Bharati, where it is all about Kali calling him. And that's why he says, who can possess Krishna? He whom Kali already possesses. And he uses a word like a sweetness dire, a love more ruthless. Love is ruthless. Kali's love is ruthless. Sri Krishna's sweetness is dire. Suddenly it reveals itself to Arjuna as time the destroyer. He is destroying all things, a whole universe. So this is the vision of the Lord of all existence as the universal creator, but also the universal destroyer. This is something very unique, and especially in Sanatana Dharma, you see that destruction is also regarded as having its aspect of the divine. Kali, Shiva on one side destroys with his tandav, on the other hand he creates by Lasya. When he opens his third eye, love itself is destroyed. But what love? Love in its vital, personal aspects. So that's how we see, and that's why it's very difficult sometimes to understand Sanatana Dharma. Some people who don't understand, they say, oh, why is Krishna instigating violence? War, violence, anger are very different things. War is an external thing, battle, something outward. Anger is a dark inner state, sign of weakness. Shri Krishna never tells Arjuna that you should be angry because this has happened to you and therefore you should fight. Not once. In fact, he says you must conquer your anger. Anger leads to a complete disgrace and downfall. Violence is primarily an inner state. The will to harm and injure is violence. Here, that is not the will at all. The will is to fulfill the divine in creation, in front of which there are those who stand as if between the divine will and the fulfillment of that will in creation. That has to be removed. Here it's not with the spirit of violence that Arjuna has to approach. Violence is again a sign of weak vital. It's like when you are laying a garden bed, you have to remove the thorns. You have to pluck out the weeds. If you say, no, I'm not going to do it, everything is fine. Now, the beautiful plants will not grow. If you have to build something, you have to remove the old. There is no second way. So here, that's what Sri Aurobindo is revealing to us. So what does the scripture say? Ancient scripture, the sages and the heroes are his food and death is the spice of his banquet. Kathopanishad, where young Nachiketa asks death, can you describe to me that supreme being, Yama? Yama says, oh, you want me to describe that supreme being? Do you have the fire to behold? So then he says, there the sun lights not. All the stars appear dark in his presence. And the sages and heroes are meat, and I, death, am a spice in his banquet. Do you have the power to behold that vision? And that's how that cycle ends. So he's saying that that's how the Upanishad saw it. So, all the more, we are interested in knowing who is this, what is this? Life, a battle and a field of death. Last line of this paragraph. This is Kurukshetra, God the terrible. This is the vision that Arjun sees on that field of massacre. So then, of course, there is a passage which talks about war is the father of things, which Heraclitus, the famous Greek philosopher, he spoke about it. And if you really look at it, it is through war that things come into existence. How? Whenever there are, at our level we can understand, there is a war of ideologies. And at the end, something becomes a victor. And then that ideology wins. And typical example, not a very good example, but still nevertheless, American freedom. So I often ask, whom did they get free from Independence Day? So they declared freedom from the Queen. They had all come from Europe. But they said, no, we don't want to follow them. We want to have our own way of life, our own constitution. So they had their own eventually constitution, a one-page document, and eventually, yes. Because, so there was a war. There was a civil war. There were several wars, and then they established. If you look at India as a nation, So many wars over millenniums. And then every time that India had to establish itself, its ideal, its value, what it truly believes in, there was a war. Ramayana war was that. Mahabharata war is that. And then of course we know that the freedom movement, and eventually every time you have to establish something, there is the past which will not allow it. And there is a clash between the two. But at the end of it, something is born. Beautiful. That's how the war has to be understood. The labor pangs. And in that, when the child is coming into existence, the old covering, which was acting like a comfort zone for the baby, has to be destroyed. If you don't destroy it, the child will not come out. So this is how war has to be understood. War is the king of all. And couple of lines below, from a clash of material or other forces, everything in this world, if not the world itself, seems to be born. By struggle of forces, tendencies, principles, beings, it seems to proceed, ever creating new things, ever destroying the old, marching one knows not very well whither, to a final self-destruction, say some. In an unending series of vain cycles, say others. So there are these different viewpoints. Looking at war, people say, oh, ultimately, see, man will destroy himself because war is. But if you look at the creation, our beautiful moon that we so much admire today, how it came into existence. One asteroid came and hit the earth so badly. And out of earth, a ball of mud was thrown out. And it sort of went far enough to start spinning and become a satellite of the earth. And that eventually becomes the moon which poets today sing its glory. But how did it come into existence? Imagine the impact of the asteroid. And eventually the moon emerging, which today we appreciate. So this is how the war. But Sri Aurobindo's view, in progressive cycles, is the most optimistic conclusion, leading through whatever trouble and apparent confusion towards a higher and higher approximation to some divine apocalypse. This is the meaning of pralaya. So we look at the world, it is imperfect, but we have to understand its work in progress. And through all these things, and they will continue till we have arrived at that perfection. Approximations don't work. For a time they may work, but there is a pressure from within and a pressure from above to fulfill God's will. And if you want to rest in approximation, feel very happy that, you know, we are all good, we are all one, it won't work if the hearts are not united in the divine. So that's the whole secret he is giving us towards some great divine revelation, the divine apocalypse. But all the pralayas are like that. Collapse and then further. However that may be, this is certain, that there is not only no construction here without destruction, no harmony except by a poise of contending forces, one out of many actual and potential discords, but also no continued existence of life except by a constant self-feeding and devouring of other life. You can't say, you know, even a Jain Muni who says, I will not allow bacteria and this thing, I will not eat, you know, things which grow as roots below the ground. Still you eat vegetables. It is living, if you want to put it like that. You can't fool, you can't do it. You are still devouring it. So without this devouring, there cannot be. Life itself is created through an act of destruction. Even flower that fall, they enrich the ground. And throughout this happens. And this principle is so beautifully recognized. Recently I read something very beautiful, that instead of just putting people in the grave, now they have made a biodegradable capsules in which you put the body and put inside and plant a tree. So that tree will, as this degrades, the tree develops. And it's like that which has gone, died, has given rise to a new life. And you can connect with the tree. It's something very remarkable. See, there's an new things which are coming into existence. Of course, the idea of planting tree over the grave is known, but this way in a biodegradable form. So, our very bodily existence, our very bodily life is a constant dying and being reborn. The body itself, a beleaguered city attacked by assailing, protected by defending forces whose business is to devour each other, and this is only a type of all our existence. So we know that 7 times the body cells are completely destroyed. Imagine a scenario where body cells don't die. It's cancer. So they have to die and renew themselves. So that's why when people sometimes when they see destruction and they say, oh, there should not be any destruction. You have to ask a question. So there, you mean there should be no new construction. No new construction can be without destruction. Even the best of things, because they are dated, time comes when they have to be rebuilt. They have a date, they have a time. So nothing in this world is permanent except the divine will. So the first law of this world that I have made is creation and preservation by destruction. This is what Sri Krishna reveals to him. And then of course today we talk about the food chain. But Upanishad knows about it. So what does the Upanishad say about the food chain? It says in a very remarkable way. The eater eating himself is eaten. Very profound truth. It doesn't use the word food chain. Food chain sounds very utilitarian. And you see the whole creation. You eat whatever you eaten, whether veg or non-veg. It has eaten the minerals and things from the earth. And when you die, you are eaten up by all the moths and all the creatures below. It's a constant process that is going on in life. Eater eating himself is eaten. And there is another great saying of the Upanishad which Shobindo brings in the life to you, and also hunger, that is death. This is too profound. Hunger is, where does hunger come from? Various kinds of hunger. And that hunger comes from the abyss. What is it seeking? It is seeking ultimately the divine infinite, which alone can fill it. That's why the human heart hungry for affection. You cannot fill it except by divine love. All hunger ultimately comes from the, it's a want. So sometimes people say that I want to be happy. So I say you remove the want and you will be happy. Want. And want create the spirit of devouring. And the Ishupanishad, that's why it says, tena tyaktena bhunjita amagrida kasya siddhanam. This want, which constantly, it creates more want, it opens the abyss. See, people think, okay, let me just have a little bit of it. Alcohol, smoke and many things of life. Arey, what is there? I'm just trying. You try, you want more, and you want more, and you want little more, and more and more, and more and more. Ultimately, you want the whole world. And that's when you are struck by the balancing forces. So this is how is the formula of the material world, and Darwin of course observed it, but it is a truth which is well known to ancient Upanishads, which spoke about it in a much more profound way. Hunger, that is death. So of course Nietzsche insists upon war, though he, as Shobindo would reveal to us, he drew a wrong conclusion out of it. He saw that without war you cannot have, you can't build anything new. But in his understanding, the more powerful is the one who will survive ultimately. It's like stretching the Darwinism in a different direction. So it's not about being moral, kind or compassionate. The only moral is, if at all, it's strength. Those who are capable of overrunning others, they eventually are the ones who will head the kingdom. That was the idea of his Superman. His Superman was a being of power, an asura. Whereas, of course, power is included. As Shobindo says in Superman, you have to have power, it's an aspect of the divine. But also wisdom and love. Power without wisdom and love and compassion is where the asura goes wrong. But his idea of Superman, and Shobindo says these are the two lines along which evolution takes place. And that's the story in Ramayana. One line is Ravana. By power he rules the earth. That's the Nietzschean Superman. And the other line is Rama. Now Rama also has power, tremendous power. But he also has wisdom and love. So this is what differentiates Rama and Ravan. Ravan takes one aspect and removes all the others. And therefore he misuses force for his own egoistic purposes. And then Sri Aurobindo gives the example of Rudra and Shiva. So this beautifully captured in one of his poems, Epiphany. Wonderful poem. Where first it is Shiva who is sitting like a dove, beautiful, Ashutosh, easy to please. Ask him any boon, he'll give you. He doesn't care. If you have reached up to that point where you are face to face with him, you can ask him anything. He is not going to ask you any questions. But if you misuse, the next moment he is Rudra. And when he assumes the form of Rudra, even the gods run helter-skelter. And the demons and the asuras say, please, please, please bring back your benevolent form. Something similar we see in the Gita when Arjun sees that Shri Krishna as Kalosmi Bhava, Kalosmi, the destroyer. He tells him, please, your nice, benevolent, chaturbhuj form of Vishnu is nice, pleasing. I can't behold this. So, last four lines on page 41. We must see first what life and the world are. Afterwards, we can all the better set about finding the right way to transform them into what they should be. So, we can't do it with sentimental idealism. No, 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 everybody should be nice, everybody should, everything should be pleasant, everything should be good, and then we feel very sad when we see life is not like that. And then we somehow want to resolve it. And so, we have nice meetings, we have conferences, how to create unity, we have nice peace accords, and we have parties or meditation. You have to see what war and battle are about. If you don't have the courage to see, you won't find a solution. That's the whole catch. If this repellent aspect of existence holds in itself some secret of the final harmony. You see, what really is conflict? It's invariably between past way of life and the future that is to be born. Always every conflict can be resolved into these two. One is a comfort zone which has been created by a way of life. The other is a new way of life which wants to impose itself. Because its time has come, its hour has come. If you don't have the conflict, if you concede to it beautifully, with plasticity, surrender, then everything is beautiful. If you don't, if you resist, then the time spirit, when the time comes, it doesn't care who you are and what you are. This is the whole secret. And then he talks about this gospel of harmlessness, of course. We know that. And it's very interesting because Sri Aurobindo has anticipated Gandhi and all these people who are, essays on the Gita is written earlier. So, what is this principle of harmlessness? No, no, but all that is fine. But we have been told ahimsa paramo dharma. So, how are we to reconcile that? So, he takes this in thoroughness. Page 42, second para, few lines from below. It is impossible, at least as men and things are, to advance, to grow, to fulfill, and still to observe really and utterly the principle of harmlessness. He says it's impossible, you can't do it. You try it, it means things will remain stuck in the mud of the past. That's how it will be. We will use only soul force. Okay, we'll just sit and meditate and want problems to be cleared. We will use only soul force and never destroy by war or any even defensive employment of physical violence. Good. Though until soul force is effective, the asuric force in men and nations tramples down, breaks, slaughters, burns, pollutes, as we see it doing today. But then at its ease and unhindered, and you have perhaps caused as much destruction of life by your abstinence as others by resort to violence. You can't keep your hands clean and say, I have not done anything. I am not doing anything. People are fighting with each other. Sometimes you have to throw your weight on the right side of history. And what that side is, we'll see it very interestingly. And it will give us an understanding and insight into also what's happening here. It's very interesting. But even soul force, when it is effective, destroys. And then he of course gives his own example that how he himself has used soul force and how devastating it can be. Few lines below. Evil cannot perish without the destruction of much that lives by the evil. You can't say, no, all human beings are very nice, I am not going to touch anybody, but I want evil to go away. It won't work. Because there are those who represent evil. And here evil is not just the wickedness, the kind of, basically the root of evil is crass selfishness. Pleasure-seeking humanity. All this is evil. Pleasure-seeking humanity may be nice, but it's ultimately detrimental to the higher cause. So all this, you say, it's okay. Life is like that. Life is not like that. It cannot remain like that forever. It can be allowed till a certain point of time, but you have to graduate. So that's how. But he goes on to say something still further. Moreover, and this is important, every time we use soul force, we raise a great force of karma against our adversary, the after movements of which we have no power to control. And I take this example of the Indian context. So much was happening. So many people would have gone through suffering. So what happens to that soul force? Once it bounces back, you look today the economy of Britain. You look today, you know what is happening to Pakistan. You look today, you know why the whole people who had done genocide, at least in the Indian context, now they are being bombarded from every side because it's going to continue. Because you can't, it will create instruments and who are going to rise up and revolt and destroy. It happened the other way also. It is true that many rich people, even in India, they did treat the downtrodden, the fallen as an outcast. So it was bound to happen that a time will come when they will rise up in revolt. So this is how things work. And then he gives the example of Vasishtha using soul force against the military violence of Vishwamitra. So Vishwamitra wanted the Kamdhenu. Vasishtha, as the story goes, Vasishtha is a Kshatriya king who is also a yogi. And he one day loses his way and he reaches Vasishtha Ashram and says, do you have something which can feed my army? And he says, yes. So Kamadhenu, the cow of plenty, is there. And she, out of herself, brings out everything possible to eat and they have a gala meal. But instead of being grateful, Vishwamitra says, I want this cow. And Vasishtha says, no, you can't have it. He says, I am the emperor. How can you stop me? He says, you may be the emperor, but this cow cannot be just because you are an emperor. You don't deserve it. And then there is a fight. So when there is a fight, when the army of Vishwamitra wants to attack Vasishtha, Vasishtha simply, Kamdhenu, brings out of herself armies which defeat him. And then he raises this question, what is this power that this man has which I don't have? That's how his yoga in pursuit of power. And many things happen. So he used soul force. Vasishtha didn't have an army. But what happened? The story did not end here. Because Vasishtha used soul force, this soul force went around. Now Vasishtha is a Brahma Rishi. Vishwamitra is a Chakravarti Raja. He is a Samrat. So forces came from all over and they continued to attack the kings of the land. Huns and Shaks coming from outside. Huns who came from Mongol region. They were not Mongols, but very similar. Shaks who came from the Central Asia. And they came pouring. So how to understand this? Say for instance, in a field like this one, there are things which are happening which we don't like. For decades they are happening. Like a rot is developing and people remain quiet. But they don't want to fight. But they use soul force where they go and pray to the mother. What is going to happen? It is going to bring certain forces which will be devastating in their effect. And therefore he says, sometimes better to stay the hand of the aggressor physically. And it's so true. Sometimes we say, children, freedom, don't say anything, whatever they do, freedom. Then what happens? A time comes when something much greater comes and hits them hard. This is a story in India of this dacoit who, when he was being hanged, he was asked one wish. He says, I want to give a tight slap to my mom. And his mom loved him like anything. He says, why? He says, had she slapped me when I was a child, I would not have been where I am today. This is not to say one should slap a child. Never. But there are ways and means. You can't turn your eye away. You can't say it's okay to be what? You have to explain. You have to be firm. You have to talk to the child. Certainly not slap because it makes his consciousness distorted. But equally you can't say whatever a child does is fine because freedom. Mother speaks about it, that this is not the meaning of freedom. Discipline is important. And if you don't do discipline a child, one day the world will discipline him. And that's going to be dangerous. Because world will not care like you. So when the world tries to discipline you, it doesn't bother who you are or what you are. You may be your mama's blue-eyed child, but the world will not stop at that. That's what he's reminding us. That this idea of I will not do anything, I will remain inert, immobile, things will happen somehow. They won't happen somehow. There is a process and a mechanism. So we have two choices. With plasticity, hand over ourselves in the hand of Krishna to the divine. And obey the will. Don't create complications with it. Or the other point is the will fulfill itself, but through much destruction. This is the only two choices human beings had. And of course, at the end he says, page 43, strife and destruction are not all. There is the saving principle of association and mutual help, as well as the force of dissociation and mutual strife. A power of love no less than a power of egoistic self-assertion. An impulse to sacrifice ourselves for others, as well as the impulse to sacrifice others to ourselves. He says that I'm not saying that you must take a flag and start a march and start doing fight everywhere. But there is something known as self-defense, and there is something known as fulfillment of the great plan of the divine. This we must remember. So while love is superior, unity, harmony, peace are wonderful things. But we can't have it if we don't face life squarely with the facts of existence as they are, which they have come in the course of evolutionary process. And he says that even love of God has become cause of so much of destruction, because man's heart has to be ready for that law. And he gives several examples of how karma operates. Page 44, third para, toward the last 7-8 lines. We must look existence in the face if our aim is to arrive at a right solution. We cover up things. So very often one of the ways that when people come and say certain things about whatever is happening, so I ask them, is that the full truth? Or is there something more? Like you will see people come and say, oh, you know, a husband will come and say, my wife is this, my wife is that. So I say, why not you call her? Is this the full truth? People have this natural tendency to cover, and they believe in the lie. Cover up is okay, but you believe in it. And then slowly, nothing else has to be done. Just to ask, is this all? Is there something which is not being shared, which is not being revealed? Then you will see that there are things which are there, which have invited a blow. That's how Shubhendu says in Hour of God. Each insincerity of nature wants thy defense against the eye of the master and the light of the ideal. Now becomes a gap in thy armor and invites a blow. And he says the blow will come. Even if you have been thrown somewhere, the blow will come and cast you down in the midst of your triumph. But then he says, but being pure, cast aside all fear. Even if you seem to have passed away, you will return because you have stood by the sincerity of your faith and the light of the ideal. God is not only the destroyer, but the friend of creatures. So Krishna there is as destroyer. But what does Krishna reveals about himself to Arjuna? He says, I am Suhridaya, I am the friend of all creatures. What is this friend doing? Destroying. So the whole thing is about God's ways in the world. He is clearing the weeds and the thorns so that this battlefield can become a playground of the divine. Unfortunately, those who are caught in that state have to go through that state. Nobody survived the battle of Kurukshetra, both sides, except 18. Out of 18 million. Can we imagine? So, but of course, when you stand on the right side of history, as he said, even if he seems to pass away, he will return. So it's so important to stand by what is true and beautiful. Not only the cosmic trinity, but the transcendent, the terrible Kali is also the loving and beneficent mother. The lord of Kurukshetra is the divine comrade and charioteer, the attractor of beings incarnate, Krishna. And whithersoever he is driving through all the strife and clash and confusion to whatever goal or godhead he may be attracting us, it is no doubt of that. To some transcendence of all these aspects upon which we have been so formally insisting. What do we insist upon? Mental ideas and mental ideals. Often sentimental idealism. He will take us way past that. Transcendence of all this. Human love has to be transcendent and transmuted into divine love. Kali, the goddess of divine love. Her flower is the divine love which Mother would give on Kali Day. And what an intense love, that inner divine frenzy. She removes everything that stands between creation and the divine. In the process, the whole creation, till Mother has to say, halt. I have a plan. I am going to put this divine love in the roots and change it from within. But that's how. But where, how, with what kind of transcendence, under what conditions, this we have to discover. And to discover it, the first necessity is to see the world as it is and not rush under the our ideas, mental ideas and idealism. Learn to look at the world. What is happening? Then we will see behind. Look at existence in the face and look deeper. Then we will see what is happening. Then we will discover our own insincerities. Then we will see where we had been stuck and what he is doing. And then we will rejoice even in that destruction. As the famous poet Bhule Shah says, that I stand below your sword and I am dancing in joy as you slay every bit of me and every drop of my blood sinks in ecstasy, only thou, only thou. So this is what is being revealed to us. To observe and value rightly his action as it reveals itself at the start and now. Afterwards, the way and the goal will better reveal themselves. We must acknowledge Kurukshetra. We must submit to the law of life by death before we can find our way to the life immortal. The Gita closes with this precisely. When Dhritarashtra says, what is the end of all this? What is the conclusion of all this great war? So much destruction I can see. What kind of God is Krishna? All these things are coming into his head. And Sanjay, who has seen things with his divine vision, he says, I can't say about that. But I know these three things. One, wherever there is Krishna, wherever there is Arjuna, there is victory. The human instrument and the divine will. Second, he says, much after this war is forgotten, all its pain will be absorbed by creation. This very place which has been filled with blood, new seeds will sprout here. It will become a pilgrim site. Much after that, two things will survive. Arjun, Bhim, all these are gone. People will wonder where they were real characters or not. Two things will survive. He says, one, this dialogue which I have just heard and narrated you, which is taking place on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. This will survive everything. And the whole dance of destruction was worth it for this. And the second is the grand vision of Krishna as Time the Destroyer. This is filling my heart with joy and wonder. So one would ask, why is that vision filling his heart with joy and wonder? Why won't it, if you realize that there is no even destroyer behind the mask, it is he. When you know that there is no other destroyer, he is wearing the mask of Kali, even of death, when he kills, then you rejoice. Because you know that behind it, it's nothing else but God's will fulfilling itself. You make your choices, but we must know. That's why the mother says, whenever there is confusion, you must know that all is the divine and there is nothing else but the divine. If you put your will, human will, that too, unenlightened human will, you won't even realize where you will be thrown away. But if you turn to the divine will, even if you don't understand, at least genuinely, sincerely try to say that, I am yours. I may not be able to perceive your will, but whatever I am doing, let your will be done and not mine. Then, even if we go, we come back and come closer to the great wisdom of the Gita, the truth of the Gita and the yoga of the Gita, whose whole purpose through all this destruction, carnage, is ultimately to bring us closer and closer to the divine. So we'll close here.